And U.S. police attack students holding anti-Israel campus rallies in protest at the regime's genocide in Gaza, arresting hundreds of protesters. Hello and welcome everybody. Israel's airstrikes and artillery fire keep pounding various parts of the Gaza Strip, killing more civilians with more than 200 days into the regime's genocidal war. One of the latest attacks hit a house east of the southern city of Rafah, killing 5 citizens and injuring several others. The regime's fighter jets attacked a house in the Shati refugee camp west of Gaza City, killing a mother and her 2 children and injuring 6 others. At least 3 Palestinian civilians were killed and dozens injured by Israel's bombing of a house in Nasser neighborhood west of Gaza City. Airstrikes on Ma'an and Al-Mawasi districts in Khan Yunis killed at least 2 civilians and injured several others. The regime strikes have killed at least 79 Palestinians and injured 86 others in the past 24 hours. The death toll from the Israeli genocide in Gaza is now over 34,260, including 14,000 children. More than 77,000 people have been injured. There's no end in sight to Israeli raids on the occupied West Bank. The regime's forces have carried out an incursion into the city of Ramallah. A 16-year-old boy was killed after they fired live rounds on a group of Palestinians. The regime has intensified its raids and attacks across the occupied territory since launching a genocidal war on Gaza in October. We were earlier joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mokandil, for more details.
It's obvious now that every time the Israeli forces storm Palestinian areas, villages, towns, cities, the Israeli soldiers use their guns, even if there are no threats against them from the Palestinians. This time, Israeli soldiers raided the city of Ramallah, stormed Abtiri area, stormed the old town of Ramallah, as well as the Umm Sharayit neighborhood, in order to arrest Palestinians. This is what the Israeli military continue to justify the raiding of Palestinian areas. During the military Ramallah, Israeli soldiers opened fire at Palestinians who went to the streets in order to prevent any Israeli aggression against the people. During the military, the forces opened fire, shot and killed 16-year-old Khaled Arkawi. Khaled Arkawi from Jenin city, and the Palestinians in Jenin city and refugee camp mourned Khaled Arkawi, and they were expecting his body to be transferred from Ramallah to Jenin in order to be buried there.
Well, U.S. police have arrested nearly 100 pro-Palestinian protesters at the University of Southern California as campus demonstrations continue to spread across the country. American students from California to Massachusetts hold sit-ins in support of Palestinians in Gaza. The protesters call for a ceasefire in the besieged strip and an end to the U.S. support for the Israeli regime. Some of them chant slogans such as "Jews want the end of the war" on many campuses. The students have set up tents to press their demands. They're also calling on U.S. universities to divest from companies with ties to Israel. Hundreds of students and others have been arrested at Columbia, Yale, and New York University since Friday. Pro-Palestine protests have been held in numerous other universities in Texas, Ohio, California, New York, and Michigan. Earlier, journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas joined us from London with his take on the growing student protests in the United States despite police cracking down on pro-Palestine activists.
Well, you see, the Zionist and Israeli Hasbara, their control of American political system, their control of the media, these are all well-known facts by those of us who are aware of what Zionism is and how powerful it is around the world, and how its networks have really been able to overrun so many, especially the Western institutions, let alone talking about the East as well, which are often subsidiaries of Anglo-Zionist imperialism anyway. So what they've done with this system is they've kept people ignorant. Most Americans didn't know anything about Zionism. They probably wouldn't even have known what Zionism actually even means, the definition of it. And they wouldn't have known really what Israel was up to inside their own territories also. So there's a lot of ignorance. But of course, single-handedly, Netanyahu and his government and Joe Biden and his callous support for this genocide has woken so many people up. I mean, to the point where here in Britain and over there, what you're getting is statistics. I mean, Ipsos and the Brookings Institute have given statistics, and then there are the YouGov statistics here in Britain. All of them reflect the same thing, that basically the Western public, the British public, the American public, are now around 66 to 70% against Israel in one shape or form.
The global outcry over the Israeli massacre and mass burial of Palestinians in Gaza is now at fever pitch. In the latest development, the European Union has called for an independent investigation into the discovery of mass graves at two Gaza hospitals that were destroyed by Israel.
We are gravely concerned by the reported discovery of mass graves in Khan Yunis and in Al-Shifa Hospital. This is something that forces us to call for an independent investigation of all the suspicions and all the circumstances, because indeed it creates the impression that there might have been violations of international human rights committed. That's why it's important to have independent investigation and to ensure the accountability.
The UN Rights Office has also demanded a transparent and independent probe into this issue. It called the development a serious violation of international human rights law and international humanitarian law. During recent days, more than 300 bodies have been recovered from Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis and Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Reports say the bodies were buried beneath piles of waste and included women and the elderly. Author and journalist Eric Wahlberg says the tide is turning against Israel as the regime's Western allies are now questioning and even condemning its conduct in the ongoing Gaza genocide.
It's interesting that it also is having repercussions even throughout the media. Google is now being forced to fire. It fired 20 of its staff who are associated with Israel and its war crimes, and there's strong pressures to break off all its cooperation. A lot of the targeting, the facial recognition, this was facilitated by U.S., by Google, and social media. So these issues, and then with the European Union coming out and asking for a special investigation, you can see the tide is really turning against Israel. Before, the EU wouldn't say anything. In the past, atrocities, Israel's killed thousands in the past, and very little, not a peep from Europe or from the US. But now it's really catching up. So it's a horrible massacre, it's a tragedy, it's a war crime, and let's hope that finally there will be some justice. It's interesting, the EU, he said it's for accountability too, he added that. So it's not just to it's not just to make a scene, but it's to target Israel, to force it to comply.
The Yemeni army says it has carried out fresh operations in the Red Sea targeting two American and Israeli vessels in international waterways.
The naval forces of the Yemeni armed forces carried out a military operation targeting the American ship Maersk Yorktown in the Gulf of Aden with a number of suitable naval missiles, and the hit was accurate. The Air Force targeted an American warship destroyer in the Gulf of Aden with a number of drones, and in another operation targeted an Israeli ship, the MSC Veracruz, in the Indian Ocean with a number of drones. Both operations have achieved their objectives successfully.
Army spokesman Brigadier General Yahya Sadeh announced the operations in a statement on Wednesday. He said the new operations were conducted in response to British and American aggressions against Yemen, as well as in solidarity with Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. He stressed that the Yemeni armed forces will continue to prevent Israeli or any ship heading toward ports in occupied Palestine via Red and Arabian Seas. He added the operations would last until the regime stops its aggression against Palestinians in Gaza and ends its siege of the coastal sliver. And Germany has withdrawn a warship from the Red Sea following the failure of an EU military mission to confront Yemen's maritime campaign in support of the Gaza Strip. The frigate had been deployed in the strategic waterway in February in the face of pro-Palestine operations by the Yemeni armed forces. Abdulatif Al-Washali reports from Sana'a.
Following the failure of the so-called International Naval Coalition to halt the Yemeni army's pro-Palestinian assaults against Israeli-affiliated vessels, the German frigate FGS Hessen has left the Red Sea after 58 days, concluding its mission alongside an American and British coalition. This coalition aimed to safeguard Israeli navigation amidst Yemeni forces imposing a stifling blockade on Israeli maritime traffic.
A bigger war was looming large after the appearance of Western fleets in the Red Sea. The vision has now become clear after the operations of the Yemeni army and Ansarullah against Israeli ships. Certainly, there is another tactic, vision, and attempts to find solutions after the Western failure to stop the Yemeni attacks. The withdrawal is not a radical withdrawal and may be a strategic change in Western plans in the Red Sea.
While some military experts speculate that this German departure may indicate repositioning and preparation for a major regional war, the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs welcomed the withdrawal, underscoring Sana'a's primary concern for the safety of international maritime navigation. He urged the world to treat Yemen with respect to safeguard their interests.
The departure of the German frigate from the Yemeni coast is the beginning of the departure of many ships, despite American pressure on countries to join the U.S. operations in the Red Sea. In fact, the Yemeni army possesses weapons carrying new surprises that will force all Western ships to leave. We are prepared for any scenario that the West is planning, whether returning to a broader war or otherwise. Our siege on Israel will continue and will not stop unless the aggressive war on Gaza stops.
Germany's FGS Hessen becomes the fourth warship to depart from the Red Sea since the inception of the European Union's naval mission Aspides, which alongside the US-led coalition has failed to protect Israeli-affiliated vessels from Yemeni attacks supporting Palestinian resistance.
With Yemen's armed forces having successfully attacked over 100 vessels linked to Israel, observers speculate that recent Western actions may indicate preparation for a new phase of confrontation with Yemeni forces. However, Sana'a has reiterated that Yemen's pro-Palestinian naval operations will persist until the Israeli war on Gaza comes to an end. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Moscow has warned NATO against deploying nuclear warheads in Poland after Warsaw officials said they would welcome such a move by the Western military alliance. The Russian deputy foreign minister said NATO nuclear weapons in Poland will be on the military target if deployed there. Sergei Ryabkov also called the potential deployment a threat to Russia's national security. On Monday, the Polish president said Warsaw is ready to host nuclear arms if NATO decides. In the face of Russia's reinforcing its armaments in Belarus and Kaliningrad. In June 2023, President Vladimir Putin of Russia confirmed that Moscow had sent tactical nuclear arms to Belarus, which borders Ukraine and Poland. The U.S. says it has secretly sent a large number of long-range ATACMS missiles to Ukraine in recent weeks to be used in its war with Russia. According to the State Department spokesman, the missiles arrived in Kiev earlier this month and were part of an aid package approved by President Joe Biden in March. Vedant Patel added that the delivery was not announced at Kiev's request to maintain operational security for Ukraine. A Defense Department spokesperson also confirmed that the long-range variant of the missiles, which can hit targets up to 300 kilometers, has been supplied to Kiev earlier this same day. Russia announced that it would further expand its buffer zone inside Ukraine if the country received long-range missiles from the U.S. Afghan population is facing severe food insecurity, putting them one step away from famine. As the situation nears a critical point, Afghans are already struggling to secure the basic needs for survival. Rahmatullah Baghman reports from Kabul.
A recent United Nations report predicts that approximately 16 million individuals in Afghanistan will be struggling to gain access to food this year. To get a better understanding of the situation, we visited a family in Kabul facing acute food shortages. The Rukhsana family's daily struggle mirrors the difficulties faced by countless households across the country.
I lost my husband during the war in our hometown. I don't have a male provider and I can't find a source of income. One of my grandkids polishes boots, but that is not enough for our family. It has been a long time since the last time we had rice and potatoes in our home. We barely eat two meals a day, which is stale breads and tea. My children are asking for soup and I feel so bad as I can't make it for them.
Our situation here is so difficult that we can hardly survive. It is because there is no income or food to eat. If we eat during the day, we should sleep with empty stomachs at night. There are people who skip meals to feed their children. Some families beg for food but fail to find some because almost no one has a better situation. We used to receive some aid from the United Nations World Food Program, but now it is gone and has left people to their fate.
According to the UN report, the Afghan population cannot fulfill essential needs, including health care, food, employment, and shelter. Some local experts argue that the current hardships faced by Afghans stem from prolonged foreign interventions and conflicts, suggesting that those involved bear a responsibility to aid in the crisis resolution.
I think all the misery and economic hardships that Afghans are going through today stem from the shameful U.S.-West intervention and wars in Afghanistan. If they had let us build constructive economic relations with our neighbors, we would not be so broken today. The U.S. and its allies are responsible because they came and destroyed our infrastructure here, and on the other hand, they imposed economic sanctions after their withdrawal. Today, they cannot turn a blind eye on what they have created.
As the international community's attention shifts away from Afghanistan and the foreign aid continues to shrink, the Afghan people still hope for a means of survival that will pull them back from the edge of crisis. Millions of Afghans are facing emergency levels of food insecurity and malnutrition. The UN agencies warn that the situation is expected to worsen rapidly if urgent action are not taken by the global community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Eyewitnesses said that during the Zionist regime's invasion of the Nuseirat camp, invading Israeli forces targeted everyone and everything that moved in the northern part of the camp. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, during the last few days, Nusayrat in the central Gaza Strip has been the target of relentless Israeli regime bombardment and artillery shelling. Israeli occupation forces invaded the camp under intense fire, and they only withdrew after several days due to the stiff resistance they met. Before the invasion of the camp, many Palestinians who had been displaced in the southern area of the Strip for months had decided to return to their homes in central Gaza. The decision was made on the basis of many considerations. First, there is no safe place in the war-torn Strip. As repeatedly stated by many institutions and organizations throughout the 6 months of the Zionist regime's genocidal war on Gaza. Second, life conditions in the makeshift refugee camps in Rafah are unbearable due to the spread of disease and the lack of space. Third, Israeli occupation forces often threaten to invade the southernmost city of Rafah, which is now overpopulated by hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians looking for safety. Many people who decided to return to Nusayrat, however, were met by a tragic fate. It was the case of Mazen Matar Abu Muhammad, who was displaced to Rafah City with his family for months and decided to go back to his house just a few days before the Israeli invasion of the camp. Amr al-Saidawi told the Palestine Chronicle, I met our neighbor, Abu Muhammad, on Sunday afternoon. I hadn't seen him in several months because he and his family had been displaced to the south. I missed him a lot, so I warmly greeted him. He told me that he was going to check on his home, located in Al-Mufti area, north of Nusayrat. I was worried about the shelling and I asked him not to go, but Abu Muhammad insisted because he wanted to assess the condition of the building. After half an hour, however, the Zionist regime shelling intensified in Al-Mufti area and Al-Saidawi learned that his beloved neighbor had been murdered. Al-Saidawi said, Abu Muhammad entered his house and walked around, inspecting the damage caused by the continuous shelling on the camp since the beginning of the war. He continued, he stayed in the house for only a few minutes. Then he hurriedly left due to the intensification of the Israeli shelling. Al-Saidawi explained, Abu Muhammad rushed out of his house to return to his family, who were still living in a tent in Rafah City. He closed the door of his house, but he could barely walk a few steps. Abu Muhammad's children were waiting for their father to return with some summer clothes, as they were still wearing winter clothes when they were displaced to Rafah, but he returned to them as a martyr, and they will have to face the war without his support, Al-Saidawi explained in tears. Eyewitnesses said that during the invasion of the camp, invading Israeli regime forces targeted everyone and everything that moved in northern Nusayrat. Ahad Matar told the Palestine Chronicle, our neighbor Muhammad Shahada was targeted by an Israeli quadcopter as he stood at the door of his house, and he died from his wounds 2 days later. Matar continued, the son of another neighbor from Al-Wawi family was also injured while sitting in his room. The quadcopter fired a bullet at his neck, and he's still receiving treatment at the hospital. Anas al-Hawajiri told the Palestine Chronicle, the latest operation was the toughest for the residents of the Nusayrat refugee camp. The latest military operation was carried out in a surprise move by the Zionist regime army, and the residents of the northern areas of the camp were not able to leave their homes due to the relentless shelling. Al-Hawajiri said, the occupation targeted the house of our neighbors from Abu Atiyeh family, killing and wounding its members, adding that hundreds of buildings and residential units in the camp were destroyed. Al-Hawajiri continued, the occupation killed everything and everyone that moved in the northern areas of Nusayrat. It targeted civilians with airplanes, artillery shells, and a hail of bullets using vehicles and quadcopters. He said, we managed to leave our home, but when we returned, we found our home turned into rubble. We lost our home, our shelter, our refuge.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavita Wade. The U.S. Israeli genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip may be taking a turn for the worse. The Israeli regime has announced that it may execute the attack on Rafah, where around 1.5 million Palestinians are taking shelter from Israeli bombs. Almost all analysts across the spectrum have said that there will be mass casualties if that takes place. Furthermore, Palestinians don't have a place to go. In this edition of the program, we will look at this genocide, which has just passed the 200-day mark, and examine how Israel may be stuck in a quagmire, failing militarily in this genocide. First, let me introduce our guests. Barbara Fantina, author and journalist, joins us from Kitchener. Also joining us is Fahima Mahomet, broadcaster and TV presenter from London. I'd like to welcome both of our guests, and I'll first start with you, Robert Fantina. So we are looking at an announcement that now has been made. It was just made a couple hours back. Israel has said that it's going to move ahead with this attack on Rafah, and we're looking, obviously, at what that may entail. Now, what's interesting about what they have said, first to get your reaction, is that we are going to work to spare Palestinian civilians there, the lives of Palestinian civilians. And the question comes about, why should we believe the Israeli regime when it says that it's going to work to do that when it hasn't done that in the past?
There is no reason to believe the Israeli regime. They have no intention of protecting the Palestinians. They have no desire to do so. They are trying to tell people to go to Al-Mawasi, which is a place that is ill-equipped to handle even the people who are there now. And people who are in the southern part of Gaza have no way of getting there, transporting themselves, their families, their any possessions they might still have, of getting there. Now, also have to remember that Israel is saying it's going to work to protect civilians, but it considers any male over the age of 18 to be a, quote, terrorist. So they can just slaughter people indiscriminately and call them all terrorists. That's what they've been doing for the last 200 days. That's what they will continue to do. They have no regard for the human lives of the Palestinian people. They don't consider them humans, and they're treating them as such. What we're going to see if they do proceed with this invasion of Rafah is going to be a horrific bloodbath and slaughter that has made that will make the last 200 days that will exceed the horror of the last 200 days.
All right, Fahima, I'd also like to get your reaction on this, but in particular, when you take a look at some of the details, it is said that they're going to be moving population to the nearby city of Khan Yunis over a period of 2 to 3 weeks. That's one of the things they have said. It will then send troops into Rafah gradually, targeting areas where they claim that leaders of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas are residing in. The question then comes about, this means that any chance of a ceasefire agreement now is gone, that might as well kiss that goodbye, along with the possibility of the captives at this point in terms of any push for the Israeli regime to save them.
Absolutely, and I do agree with our guest as well, the fact that any sort of attack right now would be an absolute horror, especially with the given amount of over a million people gathered in that one particular area. And even if they were to move, we've just heard even recently that there's been mass graves in the area of Khan Yunis and others, and it's been reported that there is nowhere safe. And we cannot even guarantee that they are going to be moved safely in the time that Israel says that they are going to actually bombard that particular area in Rafah particularly. Also, it is an actual target and security alarm for even Egypt, as it is going to be quite close to their borders. And normally they do actually take sort of preempt planned sort of attacks whereby employing measures such as border patrols and surveillances and intelligence gathering and counterterrorism operations to mitigate security risks and maintain stability in the region. But now all of those things seems to be completely out of any sort of security, and they're violating any kind of security, as well as in the situation right now where there are absolutely no reason why Israel, that they, whatever they say, is going to actually remain where we can actually believe them. And we can't even see what the situation is in Palestine at the moment, in any area, because they still deny the journalists from outside to come in to report. And anything that Israel says is taken on board. So we have absolutely no clue as to what really is going on, how many people, maybe only decades later, we're going to find out with regards to the numbers. And even what we know right now is probably going to be more than quadrupled than what we even know at this very moment in time, unfortunately.
Indeed. You know, it's very interesting. We're looking at, Robert Fantina, this package of military aid that the U.S. approved going to Ukraine, and then you have some going to Israel to the tune of $26 billion. When this was signed, the ink wasn't dry, and you had the U.S. President Joe Biden say, we're going to be sending missiles, along amongst other things, to Ukraine within hours. That was his thing. Now, we're looking at just the past couple hours where Israel has made this statement that it's going to invade Rafah. Do you get the feeling that this is just a coincidence, or that Israel was waiting for this to get approved, military equipment to be sent, and maybe serve as at least a basis for the what seems to be an imminent invasion of Rafah?
Israel has delayed the invasion. They've been saying for several weeks that they're going to invade Rafah. It's just a matter of when. But now they have the weaponry to do it in a very, what they would consider a very effective way, killing tens of thousands of innocent people. And perhaps they didn't have all that weaponry before because they had used it on the first 34 or 35,000 Palestinians that they'd killed. It's also so hypocritical that the United States is sending aid to Ukraine and not to Gaza, when what Israel is doing to Gaza is astronomically more serious than what's happening in Ukraine. And yet Ukraine is getting all kinds of support, but for the Palestinians, the support the United States is sending is being sent to the perpetrator rather than to the victims. So I do think, yes, that this is timed to coincide with receiving this weaponry from the United States.
When our guest there, Fahima, Robert Fantina, when he was looking for the words as to what Israel was doing to the Gaza Strip, it's pretty much the reaction that many around the world not only have been having, but also had when they heard about these mass graves that were unveiled, not only in terms of the Al-Shifa Hospital, but also the Nasser Medical Complex, where another, I think, 20 or 30 bodies. Amongst the three massacres that involved hospitals, you remember the Al-Ahli one that was 500 plus, and Al-Shifa that are, roughly amounted to about 400. And then you have the UN coming out, official that came out and said, we have to launch an investigation. What does that mean, launching an investigation? What do they need to see? I mean, there have been sightings of people who were blindfolded and executed, amongst them women and children.
Yes, there were reports to actually suggest that when those mass graves were actually investigated, they did find that the bodies were so there's no words for it, but you cannot actually identify them. But they were in a state where there were actually arms were actually, tied up. So they were in a state where they weren't even, probably given the kind of right to actually even defend themselves or be, properly given that sort of state where they were under trial, if they were supposedly, as the Israelis say, either sort of like militants or militia or anything like that. So we would never really know. And the thing is, it is such a heightened conflict right now that even if you were to move anyone right now, they're not giving the aid for them where it cannot be reached. So to move them even further, which we know at that moment in time, it's not reaching there, which is even harder. How are they even going to survive if they are going to move them further, back to another sort of place? So it doesn't make sense as to what they're doing. And they seem to believe everything that Israel is saying and just making up excuses. And it doesn't seem to make any sense to anyone outside. That's why we're getting such an uproar, even from the universities in the USA. And it's just now where everyone is not believing. And we also see the disruption that's happening in Tel Aviv itself against Netanyahu. But even though we have so many of their own people that are, fed up of what's going on and they want, to see much better sort of outcomes as to what's happening, we do need to realize that with the backing and the ally that Israel has, there is unfortunately going to continue with this destruction and this genocide and this continuous mass sort of murdering without consequences. Because as we know from the Iraq war, when, even up till now, we're waiting for even international courts to even, deem that to be sort of illegal. So this, again, is going to be something that unfortunately does not look like they will actually be held account.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
There have been mass movements on this in the form of protests, but in particular, our guest there touched on it, Robert Fantina, and those are student protests that we've seen erupt on college campuses. And it's quite interesting that you're having these Ivy League colleges actually be the ones that seem to be headlining it, like Columbia or Harvard or Brown or Yale. And what's more interesting about this is that this has been going on for quite some time, actually. It broke out when the Operation Al-Aqsa flood broke out. There were these protests. But this time I think it's different. First of all, you're looking at encampments, these tents that are set up. It kind of reminds us of Zuccotti Park, if you remember, back in the Wall Street protests back then. But what do you think of these student protests? They want basically, they're looking at a boycott type in terms of their charter, if you want to call it that they should cut ties with companies that make money that goes to Israel. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, many of these universities have financial ties with Israel, and the students are demanding, among other things, that those ties be cut because they violate the university's charters and their standards of human rights, and they want nothing to do with it. They don't want to benefit from any monies coming from Israel. They're also demanding a ceasefire, and the school administrators are not listening to them. Therefore, they've taken to these actions of these encampments, which are peaceful. They're legal because these are students, at least most of them. Some non-students have come onto the campus occasionally, but most of them are students who are camping on university property. They're paying tuition to go there, and they have the right to be there. And these are expanding, as you mentioned, across the country. They're going to continue to expand. The school year is ending in just a few weeks for most of the students, but this isn't going to come to a close then. These students will be involved in Youth for Palestine movements in their communities, and then thanks to social media, they will be in contact with each other and with countless others who feel that they the way they do. They'll continue to work for justice for the Palestinians. That's what we're seeing now. It's a wonderful movement to see. It needs to expand. It needs to continue.
Yeah, and you know, one of the events that happened here, I don't know if you recall, it was back in November of last year, where there was the largest pro-Palestine protest in the U.S., where the destination was the White House. And I think there was over 250 groups that were involved. This was a mass mobilization, the biggest one that the U.S. has witnessed. If you combine that with the student protests that are taking place, do you agree with what one analyst said, that, you know, this is the younger generation? They don't think of Israel the way that the older generation did. It's a new ballgame now, and they do not want the support that the U.S. is giving them, mainly due to the genocide taking place, but in particular because of the way they've treated Palestinians. Do you agree?
Absolutely, and that's why there's been the ban that has been approved for TikTok, because they know that how widespread social media is to actually get information out there. But regardless of that, we can now thank social media and sort of the digital platforms outside the mainstream and the propaganda media on the mainstream sort of channels. So people are much more aware of actually what's happening. And what amazingly has come out of this is that everyone has actually learned the true history and destruction over decades of what's been happening as Israel being the oppressor, the apartheid, and all of so many illegal, inhumane things that they have been getting away with for so many decades, that now people are totally awakened by this. And the new generation and the current generation is definitely not going to be quiet about this, because it affects their future, it affects their lives, and it affects their children. And, you know, that old mindset, and even the most powerful, maybe lobbyist groups, are really terrified, because when they speak and when they erupt as young as they are, it makes a difference to the future. So I think it's really powerful. It needs to continue. And even if these voices may not actually, you know, go into making differences in policies, but the fact that it's causing the disruption that it has, where the entire, even certain universities, have now actually stopped learning in the campus and actually going online, shows that it does, you know, make and serve some sort of movement to say that if we're not heard, then we are going to cause this disruption and cause some sort of discourse where we need to be seen and heard according to their normal human rights, because we're speaking up for the voiceless. And again, they're not going to accept the general and the normal rhetoric and narrative that has always been.
Well, talk about change. And this was something that was really, I don't know, it was really shocking to hear. And it was in the form of the U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. I don't know if you remember that, Robert Fantina, where he came out and he said, "I worry under his leadership in reference to Netanyahu, Israel will become a pariah in the world, and even in the U.S. Without American support, Israel's future could well be over." I mean, this kind of goes with the theme of our program tonight, where Israel is not only stuck in a quagmire, but the U.S. is helping it, and it's still stuck. But the point of view, the stance that he has, you could never imagine that. I don't think you're in the States there, Robert. Something that U.S. politicians would say years ago, even, what Chuck Schumer said.
Yes, it was. It would have been unheard of just a few years ago. Everything, the House of Representatives and the Senate walked lockstep in concert with whatever Israel wanted. Whatever it wanted, it got in terms of money. It could do no wrong. Israel was a sort of god to the United States. But as Schumer said, that Israel risks becoming a pariah state. Israel is a pariah state on the international stage. It was certainly an outlier prior to October 7th, but since this genocide has started, we've seen people around the world in massive, massive demonstrations against Israel, against the Israeli government. These are not anti-Semitic in any means. Criticism of Israel is not criticism of Jewish people or Jewishness, but we are seeing that the nation of Israel is a pariah on the world stage, as Schumer predicted, and it's not going to change unless the Israeli government changed its policies, which would be drastic, and there is no indication that's going to happen now. Netanyahu has said there will never be an independent Palestine on his watch. Biden vetoed the admission of Palestine into the United Nations as a full member just a week or so ago. So the United States and Israel are both pariah states, and they are showing that more and more as this genocide continues.
You know, when you take a look at Israel in terms of any achievements here, what are we looking at, Fahima? I mean, it's been 201 day at this point since Operation Al-Aqsa flood. There hasn't been any achievements on the ground in terms of the two ideals that they were after, goals, elimination of Hamas and the return of captives, except for the ceasefire that took place. And now they're looking at going after Rafah and invade there. They're saying that there are going to be Hamas leaders there. What if that fails, which then points to an even darker, perhaps, plan that they have, that this is all just a cover for trying to oust Palestinians from their homeland?
That's exactly that, and maybe we might not see it as a sort of like a success story with regards to the Israeli point of view, with them actually achieving anything. But actually, they've destroyed the entire strip of Gaza. So at the end of the day, unfortunately, it is something that they have actually achieved, which is why they wanted that space for themselves. So even if people wanted to go back, they have no means of actually rebuilding again. So it would be up to them to actually take over. However, they sort of, put it into their own story as whether or not they're helping to rebuild, or again, putting on their own sort of like settlements like they have in the West Bank. And now they have complete control, because they've actually destroyed everything, so it's not even inhabitable. So at the end of the day, we have to basically understand that regardless of what we see on the mainstream, there's definitely an agenda for them to actually take over, and they've actually done that. And there have been plans even before the 7th of October, which they have actually come across, where research has been said that, they wanted to strip down that entire area, have so much built on it, have the gases that, is from there. So there has been plans way before this, regardless if it was for that particular moment in time where it happened from October the 7th, but there's definitely been an idea where they need to take over that for themselves because of what lies underneath. So it may not be the success as in getting those hostages back from the rest of the world, and that's what it is, but they've definitely succeeded, unfortunately, in displacement, in breaking and destruction of the entire region, and where even if they were to come back, they've got nothing to come back to, and they've got no one fighting for the Palestinians around, even in the Arab world, to actually even give them any support, even with just the basic aid. So unfortunately, if it's not even them pulling back, they have the problems of famine and so many other things that's going to come along with that.
Indeed. Well, I mean, you take a look at some Israeli officials, statements that they have made. Robert Fentina, the former major general Yitzhak Brick, Israel has lost his he calls it a war. We call it a genocidal war against Hamas in the Gaza Strip. You have the Israeli intel minister, days ago, he resigned. And you're having many analysts say that Israel has already lost strategically and operationally, which then puts into question of what is their motive behind continuing with this genocide, and also put into question the U.S. military assistance given to Israel.
The motive is the destruction of the Palestinian people. Israel wants all of Palestine, wants to annex the entirety of Palestine. And the way it can do that is by killing the people of, killing them all, or driving them into refugee camps in another country. The stated goals of defeating Hamas and releasing the prisoners. Well, the first one, you can't defeat an ideology. This, the people of Palestine, Gaza, West Bank, and everywhere else are going to continue to be opposed to the occupation, the brutal, repressive occupation, no matter whether that resistance is called Hamas or anything else. So that's not going to be defeated until there is a just solution to this horrific occupation. And as far as releasing the prisoners, the if the Israeli government had been reasonable, and thinking of the Israeli government as ever being reasonable is just preposterous, but had it been reasonable, it could have established a ceasefire, a permanent ceasefire, which would have released all the hostages at that time. But that's not what Israel's interested. It's not interested in really defeating Hamas. It's not interested in getting back the hostages. It's interested in killing or expelling all the Palestinians and then taking complete control and annexing the Gaza Strip.
All right, I heard a timer there, and coincidentally, we're out of time ourselves here. So thank you for that. Robert Fantina, author and journalist from Kushner. Thank you, Fahima Mohammed, broadcast and TV presenter from London. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to the end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tawai and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
An-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdi'a al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malawai.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety. This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was the pure direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. He was the 10th divinely appointed successor. He was the 10th divinely appointed imam. He was the 10th divinely appointed trustee to the final Messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. A great number of Muslims believed in the imama of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, and they found it obligatory upon them to follow and obey Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. A vast amount of legal dues and monies that must be given to the imam were carried to Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, as he was the financial epicenter of the Shia. And it was partly due to this financial leadership of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam that governmental investigators and policemen reported in detail to the Abbasid Caliph al-Mutawakkil. And so al-Mutawakkil Abbasi was the most bitter enemy of not only the Alawis and the followers of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, but he was a bitter enemy of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam himself. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Jamiatul Kabira by Imam Hadi alayhi salam, along with its English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabih at-tuja wa a'lam at-tuqa wa dawin nuha.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thought, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call in the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about the dialogues of the 10th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. So when we're talking about these dialogues, it's interesting, we find that in the era of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, that there were certain theological discussions and philosophical discussions that were occurring amongst the Muslim scholars. Now, of course, this is an era in which the Abbasid Empire was in control. And so because the Abbasid Empire and the Abbasid Caliphs, they tried their best, of course, as any empire does, which was to make their empire and their seat of power firm and stable. And so because of that, what they did was that they started to promote certain schools of thought over other schools of thought. And of course, they also promoted schools of thought in general. So this is why theological and philosophical discussions would come about. Of course, this is an era where there has been an influx of Greek literature, Roman literature, and different sciences from different parts of the world, whether it was the Western or the Eastern part of the world. And so because of this, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, as well as some of the previous divinely appointed imams, and you know, the subsequent divinely appointed imams, they had to discuss these things. So here there's certain verses of the Holy Quran that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, he discusses with one of his companions, and the verse in question says that surely Allah makes heir whom he pleases, and Allah guides aright whom he pleases. And so Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, he talks about how there are various verses of the Holy Quran that are like this, but he says that all of